LGBTQ.
Dave Radio, Fridays at noon on CITR.
Wow, wow, Dave, you're so sway.
And we're the Daves. I'm David Bedenick.
I'm Dave Campbell.
I'm Dave Frank.
We're the Daves.
And you're listening to CITR FM 101.9.
CITR Radio.
And these are the Daves of our lives.
It is Friday, the 31st of January, 2020,
And this is Dave Radio with Radio Dave on the radio. We are broadcasting live on CITR 101.9 FM and streaming on the World Wide Web at CITR.ca from our studios underlooking the agora of the palatial student nest on the Musqueam territory of Ulksen, better known to you as the Point Grey campus of the University of British Columbia. On the program today, we'll follow the story of Red Eye, a piece that started as a writing exercise for a monologue showcase and grew to become a Leo Award-winning short film, recently shown at Cannes and now available for free streaming. We'll meet the director, Siobhan McCarthy. We'll also talk to actor Kate Bessworth, currently appearing at the Havana in Clara Brennan's one-person play, Spine. And we'll let you know about upcoming auditions and other theater stuff on the call board. And in between, we'll throw in some local music. It's Vancouver's go-to hour for local, independent theater, film, and music. And it starts right now. Don't touch that dial. And let's just kick it right off. Kate Bessworth is on the line. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Dave. How you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. How's yourself?
I'm good. I'm good. We opened last night, so I'm a little tired.
That's okay. That's okay.
Other than that, I'm good.
didn't mean to overwhelm you with energy right off the start there. So tell us about Spine. Like you said, you just opened it last night. I mean, I was there. I saw it, and it's quite a show. You are, of course, on stage by yourself, but playing a few different characters. Tell us a little bit about how you found out about it and what attracted you to it.
Sure. So the director, Wendy Ballard, worked with me at Bard on the Beach a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. and approached me with the script. And it's a UK play written by Clara Brennan,
yeah.
the playwright. And it's short. It runs about an hour and 20 minutes, but it's the story of an unlikely friendship between a teenage girl and an elderly woman.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a political treatise on the power of knowledge is what I'm calling it.
Yeah, I think that's a very apt description. It's one of those stories of two people that you at first meeting you wonder what's going to happen here, how do these two people have anything in common, and then they find their common thread. The main character is Amy. She's what, 16 or something? She's a teenager.
She's 18. Yeah.
18. Okay, but she's very strong willed, very determined, very feisty, and that's kind of what I can't remember the other woman's name now, the other character.
Glenda,
yes. It kind of what Glenda finds attractive in her is that kind of independent
yes.
spirit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's that she sees kind of a twin spirit in her.
Yeah.
Glenda's extremely political, has a lot of anger about what's happened to the country, to the UK, to Britain, mm-hmm. in the time she's been alive. And then Amy has all of this anger too, but it's not based in anything substantial. It's just her life is hard.
Yeah.
Her life is hard, and she's quite lower class, and it's a real rough go for her. So Glenda sees this potential for activism in her.
Yeah, and it, quite literally, when they first meet, Amy has a black eye.
Yeah, and blood on her shirt.
Yeah. So Glenda definitely sees something that never recognizes a fighter.
Absolutely, yeah.
So what was the process for you of creating these characters and putting it on stage? I mean, Amy has a very, very pronounced Northern English accent. Is that something that you've had some skill working with?
Yes, luckily I have. When I was... I did 4 years at Shaw, the mm-hmm. Shaw Festival, and in my second year there, we did a play called When We Are Married, and that was set in Yorkshire.
Yeah.
So at that time, we had a dialect coach come in and work with everyone in the cast on that accent specifically. So when it came to the show, Wendy and I both wanted to make sure I had an accent that I felt comfortable in.
Yeah.
But also one that allowed Amy to be as funny as she is.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, the lyrical nature of the Yorkshire accent really, really worked with her character.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of room for that in there for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I had a question and now it's gone.
Well, I can talk more about process. If you
please
want.
Do. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. So, for me, the bulk of the mental work was on learning the lines. Of course.
Yeah.
It's a lot. It's a lot to keep in your brain. And the way the play works is it's not linear. As you saw last night, she jumps back and forth in her storytelling a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll even go back to rewrite sections of it that she's previously told. So the main thing for me mentally was getting the lines down. And then once we had those down, we pretty much started rehearsal with me off book when mm-hmm. we got up on our feet. So it was just playing with physicality, playing with pace, playing with energy, the difference in bodies between Amy and the other characters he plays.
Yeah.
And finding, it was really important for Wendy and me to find specific bodies so that it was clear to the audience who I was when I was, you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's, that's there's, for the audience experience, when we enter the theater, Amy's already there on stage, and because it's at the Havana, we're kind of walking over her almost, lying on the floor and
yeah.
dancing to Kate Bush and reading her books. And...
Yes. Yeah. What did you think about that pre-show? What did that do for you?
I'm always a little thrown by that because I'm not quite sure if the actor is already in character or, you know, if it's somebody I know, am I allowed to approach them or do I have to sort of step back and, you know, and then sort of watching sort of the other audience and that, how they respond to it as well. In some ways it's sort of, you know, you walk in and you're like, okay, the show's already happening. It hasn't started, mm. but we're already in the theater experience, but it can be a little off-putting.
Totally. And,
yeah.
You know, from an actor's point of view, it can be off-putting for me, too.
Yeah.
But what we were trying to do with that is just let me get used to your energy.
Mm-hmm.
And then also let you spend a little time with me before I jump right in.
Yeah. Yeah, because there's no introduction. There's no welcome to the theater, turn off your phones, monologue or anything like that. It's just
no.
The lights go down and there you go.
And then we're in, yeah.
Yeah.
And it also gives me an opportunity to be my to be Amy in front of you, to
yeah.
be vulnerable in front of you before I start, which is immeasurably helpful
mm-hmm.
as a performer.
Yeah. Now you've had a lot of experience in larger venues. You're a regular at Bard and as you said, you did the Shaw Festival. So now you're in the Havana,
mm-hmm.
this little tiny room with,
yeah.
you know, just a few seats and everyone's, you know, basically in your lap. How was that experience for you?
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it so much. Even at the larger venues I've worked at, that Bard and Shaw both have studio theaters, and for me that's one of the biggest gifts is to work in a smaller venue. So even in the Havana, you know, it's the epitome of that. It's so
yeah.
intimate that I can be quiet. I can be quiet when making a point. I don't have to project.
Mm-hmm.
You can all see my face at every moment. It's more filmic than
yeah.
any other theater I've done. And subtle. And it's really beautiful to be able to have that experience. It can be a bit, awful when you look out and someone is glaring at you or asleep. But I always think, you know, if you paid to come and have a nap, that's okay too.
Yeah. Well, I had been up early that morning, so I apologize if it threw you off. So you've got a short run. You're only on until next
uh-huh.
Saturday, the 8th. So
yes.
So people need to get on it and get on to see it. Tickets available through the Havana. And is there a brown paper tickets or other thick tickets website?
It's Showpass.
Showpass, okay. But
Showpass, Spine at the Havana.
Yeah. All right. But just look for Spine at the Havana and you'll find your way in. And then this summer you're going to be playing Henry V at Bard.
Yeah, sure am.
Wow, that's going to be an adventure for you.
I'm so excited.
Yeah.
But I, in this this changing theater climate, I'm being able to play roles that I never thought would play.
Yeah.
And that is so thrilling and so unexpected and such a huge gift.
Well, great. Well, congratulations. Spine is definitely a treat to watch, and looking forward to seeing you as Hank Sank this summer.
Thanks so much, Dave. It was lovely talking to you.
Okay, you too, Kate. Thanks a lot. Take care.
Okay, bye.
So that's Robin Lane, and a tune called Memories of Mali. So sitting across from me now are Laurie Watt. Say hello, Laurie.
Well, hello there.
There you are. Just move the mic in. And Siobhan McCarthy, hi.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Well, thanks for coming in. So now we're here to talk about your film Red Eye, which has quite an exciting story behind it.
It does.
Yeah, it's
take it away, Siobhan.
Yeah. Now, as we were talking before we turned the mics on, the genesis of this film is actually from, which is basically John McGee's writing project called The Chair Series that we've talked about on the show a few times. But maybe just to remind the audience of what The Chair Series is, who would like to take that one?
I can give it a try.
Yeah.
So The Chair Series is from the brainchild of John, who I've known since my days at UBC, which was a couple decades ago.
just yesterday.
John loves to have his actors give him a word.
Yeah.
And then he writes a monologue based on that word. And then it's old school theater. You know, it's a black box. It's a chair.
Yeah.
It's monologue. I mean, no props, no costumes.
It's literally a chair.
Yeah.
And you can sit on it. You can stand behind it. You can do whatever you want, but that's all you got.
Yeah, and so John had written a few pieces for me, and he also does this that when we do our performance, all of the performers are on stage watching the person who's in the hot seat, in the chair. And every time my dear friend Christine did her part, who I actually lived in Totem Park with however many years ago here at UBC, every time she would do her performance, I was a basket case. I was weeping, crying mess. And I was like, don't put me after her because I am like useless. I'm absolutely useless as a performer because I'm so moved by this experience of Christine's performance. So
this is Christine Gavin Bartlett.
That's right. Correct. And so Christine does such a fantastic job and I was enamored in every way. And I kind of said to John, you know, this haunts me so much. Can I make it a movie? May I option it? May I adapt it for a film? And he trusted me to do it. And it was even funny because we had a screening the other night and he kind of tapped me on the shoulder and went, really good job. And I'm like, this is your first time watching it, isn't it, John? And he was like, in its entirety. Which was kind of funny because it's been, had a great little legacy of going to Cannes and everywhere else.
Well,
but
Thank you to Women in Film and TV ABC who curated that the other night.
Oh, really?
Yeah, CineWorks
screening. Yeah. At CineWorks.
They were super fantastic.
Women in Film and TV does so many great things.
They
It's a terrific organization.
Yeah. Thank you, Ashley Evans, in particular.
So what's the story that the film is telling?
Well, it's a story of a mother who is driving her daughter to the airport to catch the red eye flight. And we find out through this drive that they've been estranged. Approximately 16 years is kind of the math that I did. And she explains that they're estranged because she was an addict. And so it's ultimately this confessional that ends on a really positive note. It's I wanted to create it as an opportunity so that there could be hope after family challenges, and that there can be reconciliation, and that there can be hope and family forgiveness after addiction. So the irony, though, is when it was originally written, John wrote it for a father and a daughter. Sorry, a father and a son scenario, not as a mother and daughter. And so it's been interesting just to kind of revisit it in how it's shifted and evolved.
But he wrote it for Christine?
No, that was one he had already actually written.
Oh, I see.
And so when she was looking through them, she was like, what about this one? And he was like, oh, it's supposed to be a father and a son.
Interesting.
And even when...
I did not know this.
Yeah.
This is new information.
And even when when she would perform it, we never knew who the child was. We never knew if it was a daughter or a son.
Yeah.
That was just my conjecture of how I framed it. And ironically, when she performs it and when we thought we were going to film it, they were all anticipating the child to be in the backseat of the car, whereas I had them in the side. So the
audience is watching from the daughter's point of view, sitting in the passenger seat in the front of the car.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so we had a lot of conversations of like, how much of the daughter do we reveal? Why not? Just trying to figure out what was the best way to tell the story. And I think what was fascinating for me as a writer and as a, you know, and when I was an entry-level filmmaker, or even as an actor, you know, it was always based on lines. Like, how many lines do you have? Like, I mean, if your actual credit is based on how many lines you have, you become very dialogue heavy and very dialogue driven. So it was a beautiful exercise for me as a filmmaker to tell the story visually and to look at, you know, how did I want to show it in regards to the different lenses we were going to work and how we got closer to the airport and closer to the mother after the confessional. We see her much more closely in a tighter ECU.
Yes, it's a beautiful technique that Siobhan uses. You actually do start in the back of the car, like you're a kid watching.
Yeah.
You're witnessing the discussion in the front, and you get closer and closer on our
It's very subtle because I don't remember noticing that.
You have to see it a few times to really catch it, I think. And it's a testament to Siobhan's filmmaking.
Aw, thanks, Lori.
I thought that was a beautiful
Thank you.
It was really lovely.
It was a beautiful exercise just in regards to the old adage of filmmaking of show, not tell.
Yeah. Because
theater is very tell, 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 tell. And, you know, you get these monologues from John and it's literally a page of text with like no spaces or paragraphs. It's just stream of consciousness.
Yeah.
So to then try to frame it and shape it so that it would be more palatable as a film was an interesting exercise.
Yeah.
So I'm happy I got the tap on my shoulder a couple days ago. Good job.
Yeah. Could you imagine if he didn't like it? I'd be so sad. That'd be awful.
You mentioned the visual aspect of it, and the most striking visual of it is the fact that there's this deep, heartfelt, bring you to tears confession mm-hmm. being told by a woman dressed as Santa's helper.
Dressed as Santa's helper, driving along Canby Street.
Yeah. In the pouring rain.
With snow.
Yeah.
I really wanted the windshield wipers to be the sound score.
Yeah.
We had Red Heartbreakers did a phenomenal job of bringing in the small little pieces of when she's really frustrated with the radio, trying to fill the silence. She tries to put the radio on, but like every song is Christmas. And she's been Santa's helper taking photos at the mall, so she's probably been inundated with Christmas music since October.
Yeah.
So by the time it's Christmas Eve, she wants none of it and was literally coming from work when she got the call, like, can you pick me up? And I mean, can you imagine a mother who's not seen their daughter for 16 years all of a sudden gets a phone call? You're not going to really care about what you're wearing. You're just you're out the door to go meet the person that you love and that you want to reconnect with. So, yeah, our costumer, Marion, was just phenomenal. She did a wonderful job.
Oh, she's great.
So thorough, to the point that even the earrings were little like Christmas ornament bells that jingled. So in post, we had to make sure that the jingles were like appropriate with however much head wagging she was doing. So, and even, I really wanted to focus on.
So hats off to the Foley artist.
Yeah.
Well done, Sandra.
And even the hands, like I find as I age, my hands start to look like my mom's hands.
Yeah.
Like that's one of these genetic things that we just kind of take on and we take accountability for them. And so I really went the beginning, you see the hands on the steering wheel and, you know, our costume designer did such a phenomenal job even to have like the gloves that were fingerless, just to have everything in place to make sure that that screen,
every shot, there was the Christmas elf.
Yeah. And just that every shot, every frame is just so richly filled. And the costume gave that juxtaposition to the traumatic dialogue that was happening, or monologue that was happening. So, yeah.
How long did it take to shoot?
We shot it 2 days. We shot at night, actually, because it's not easy being on the Canby Street Bridge with a camera hanging on the side of your car. And they were running for the red eye.
Yeah.
So that's like a nighttime.
Mm-hmm.
So it's funny, I almost forgot about what the hours were until Christine brought it up. And she's like, yeah, we would start like when it got dark and then we'd go to like 3 or 4 in the morning. And I was like, oh, yeah, we did. So
There weren't long days, though, in terms of regular film days. I don't think that we weren't doing.
No, it just felt like long nights because it's
nighttime,
because we would do all the prep during the day. I mean, I was running my kid up the hill to teach him because he was in snowboarding camp, right?
I remember,
in the car, that was like the hot set. So. Yeah, we shot 2 days principal photography with talent, and then did a quick little pickup on the following day. I really wanted to make sure we got the Christmas lights and on people's homes versus the people who choose not to decorate their homes. So just to kind of pick up the last little bits for more of those insert shots.
Yeah.
So, yeah, 2 days.
Yeah. So we out at the South Terminal Airport the one night, and then just, up and down Canby Street.
Up and down Canby. Because I had timed the monologue. There was one time when John let me not be on stage, and I filmed Christine's monologue just on my iPhone. And then there's another one that I want to do that David C. Jones performs.
Mm-hmm.
So he let me film those. So for a good month before we went to camera, I was driving up and down up and down Canby Street, timing the monologue with the lights. It was really important for me to have the lights, like everything's red lights until she gives her confessional, and then we're in green lights. So by utilizing the street lights for my set deck and for my lighting choices to help fill the mood and the storytelling of the experience between this mother and daughter, it took a while just to get that timing right. So it was funny. It felt like many hours going up and down Canby.
Well, and you were covert about it, too. You didn't let your actor know necessarily, so she didn't have to worry about timing anything properly.
No,
just
I didn't.
Letting her have her performance. And
it was interesting because I'm not allowed to direct her while she's driving.
Right.
So there would be times when, you know, we would do a run and then I would pull over to the side and I'd be like, okay, this was great. This was great. Can we tweak this a bit? Can we do, okay, now let's go do the whole run again. And we'd have to like loop all the way back, get on the Canby Street Bridge and then start heading up Canby towards the airport. So yeah, the subtle things that if you're just watching it, you're like, yeah, whatever. You wouldn't know that all the kind of work and timing that went into it to try and time a monologue with traffic lights.
Turn the heater off every time we started driving and the windshield's fogging up.
Of course,
Worrying with continuity. Like, we would want it fogged up a certain amount so that we wouldn't be having to Greek out the cars or anything beside us, yet not fogged up enough to ruin continuity or impede our ability to drive.
Don't anyone.
And I was kind of jerky. Like, I didn't let my actors know each other.
Oh, really?
And then they didn't, like, when I had them do their makeup at the beginning, like, for the very first run, I kept them very separate so that there was that awkwardness of getting to know you after being so estranged. You know, if they're sitting ahead of time having a laugh and a good chat, it wouldn't have the same dynamic if they were kind of strangers.
Bob Fraser did a theater project like that a few years ago. I forget the name of the play, but he had cast it and rehearsed it with the actors separately.
Yeah.
And
how interesting.
It was a two-hander, but he had six actors cast. So there was a woman and a man, and it takes place in the woman's apartment. So the lights come up, and we see her, in her apartment, and not knowing that someone's about to appear. The actor knows someone's about to appear, but the character doesn't.
Right.
But the actor doesn't know who's going to appear. Just the door opens and someone walks in, and they have to do the scene.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I missed that. That would be interesting.
Yeah.
So Bruce Sweeney does this as well. Bruce Sweeney, who is a great alum of UBC as well. And I had the privilege of working with him once upon a time as an actor. And that was a technique that he definitely employs.
Yeah.
I thought that I'll have to save that in my toolbox
for
another time. I mean, as a theater director, I would definitely do that to my actors, especially when we were doing a lot of work built out of improv before scripting. I would kind of give them different scenarios and then let them go at it.
Mm-hmm.
This was a little bit different because it was filmed. So,
yeah. So, Lori.
Yes.
This show got to be shown at Cannes.
It was super exciting.
How did you manage that?
Well, it was really interesting. I said to Siobhan when we originally were doing this, I said, we're going to take it to Cannes, right? Right, Siobhan? And she looked at me and there was this look on her face. I couldn't quite describe what was going on inside her brain because, of course, Siobhan's been there twice before. So I was very excited. I wanted to take it to the short film corner. We really pushed to make sure that we got the cut in on time.
At we one wore point, a I think gown. We had you wore 17... your gown when you're submitting the application.
Well, you were lending me a gown. I was trying it on. Come on now.
Yeah, it's like the old BBC newsreaders in black tie, right?
We had like 17 different cuts of this film. It was right down to the wire. I was over at Siobhan's house and we're, uploading everything. And it came down like 10 minutes before midnight, I think, on the last day. And then we found out that we were accepted and it was wonderful.
Yeah.
It was so great. We got to, we took meetings in the Canadian Pavilion and met some of the short film programmers from other festivals around the world. And it was very exciting. Siobhan was interviewed on the beach by Jared Drew, Gaze Around the World Television.
It was really fun. I mean, and Creative BC did a really great job. I had applied to them for the Passport to Markets. Yeah. So they were able to support us with the completion, like some marketing funds to help us complete our website and get our promotional material together to be market ready. I really pushed Lori to get into the producer's workshop to kind of understand more of how producing works on a global level in regards to selling and doing co-productions. Mm-hmm. I had been fortunate to be in the producers network a few times before, and I just know that was a real kind of make or break experience for me when you're sitting at a round table with the people who are making, you know, the pinnacle of film, you've arrived, so to speak. And so I felt
people they're going to be making decisions.
Yeah, I felt it was really important because Laurie has had such a strong history with stage production that I felt it was really important for her to get her teeth cut in the best market ever. And it's a friendly market.
I mean, it really is.
It's an approachable market. Yeah. Like once you're in, you're kind of good to go. I felt like it was really important for us to all go and represent the film and other projects that we want to get out there.
Yeah, I think it was really important for us to go there. I know a number of people may get their films into festivals but not necessarily be able to represent them. I think if you want to be able to take something to market and eventually have a sale or some kind of distribution deal, you really do need to – they need to see your face.
Yeah.
You need to show up. You need to maintain those relationships. Siobhan and I met this lovely woman.
Well, I think there's a value in just in just showing up and just being there.
And just showing up.
It shows your dedication. It shows your enthusiasm. Well,
and that you're excited about your film and you're excited to be there. And it was such a whirlwind. And after, of course, I said to Siobhan, I understand the look now. I get it.
Yeah, now I get it.
Yeah, you're up early, you're doing all your work.
You're at breakfast before 9 a.m., taking your meetings, doing roundtables, screenings. It's a whirlwind.
And you have to network at night, too, the networking events, and then be back up at it the next day, ready to go.
I think it's one of those places where you come to learn that as a filmmaker, your network is your net worth.
Yeah.
And our Canadian government does such a formidable and amazing job of financing and help support our local filmmaking economy. But a lot of filmmakers aren't really taught or given an example or walked through the process of getting that international sale and how to, like, they work so hard on getting the money to make the movie, but it's like not knowing how to kind of get it into the market and get it out there and how to find the audience and everything else. So one of the great things about Cannes is that it really kind of gets you on that circuit. I had been fortunate. I'd been before, and I'd been to Berlin, and I go to Toronto every year. And it's interesting because I found that as soon as people saw me at Cannes, then they start to take you a little bit more seriously.
They do.
Oh, you're really a filmmaker.
That's right, yeah.
I think I'd done 10 or 12 shorts before just with friends, but I didn't have that piece of taking something to market. Yeah. Siobhan really mentored me very well with that. And it's true. People look at you different. They treat you different.
Well, you see so many faces. You meet so many people. And to associate the face with an event or a location or something, it reinforces it.
Yeah, but you also get to know people as people. You get to learn who their kids are and what their favorite thing to eat is and how they like their coffee. And, you know, you're getting to experience relationships in a whole other jurisdiction where, you know, sometimes the pressure's off in a different way. Like, you can't be grumpy in the south of France.
No. It's way too beautiful for that to happen.
I think that's been one of the wonderful things. And we met a beautiful woman who was a distributor who ended up connecting us with the distributor that we now have on this. I mean, we did have to go to the AFM and try and catch up. And Lori has been phenomenal with her due diligence of, like, getting on the phone. Where are we at? Where are we at?
Michelle's great. She's been really a supporter right from the beginning. And how we met her was at a networking event the very first night we were there. So it's important. I know some people don't might be anxious about going to events like that, but I think it's really important that you get out there and talk to people.
And now we can see it. It's streaming on the National Screen Institute of Canada Online Film Festival.
Yes,
which
it is
now going to no longer be. So we got in
one of the last films.
Wow.
Yeah, unfortunately, I mean, I think this is something that I hope can be revisited because it's been such an amazing platform for filmmakers. It's, in my experience, I feel it comes with prestige, it comes with acknowledgement. Even our distributor was great to kind of work with us to keep it up for this period of time. The team at the NSI was absolutely amazing. Originally, they accepted our film to show for February of last year, of 2019. And I was like, oh, really? Like, we're a film about Christmas, and it's not a Hallmark film. Like, it's not a happy-go-lucky film in the same way. And I said, you know, February, people are still cursing Christmas because they're trying to pay off their visa bills. They're still dealing with like the carnage of the financial output. So I don't know. And they were great. They said, well, why don't we, you know, it's within the same calendar year when we launch it. So why don't we revisit it for November, December? And I was like, wow, that would be so much better for us to be able to do that.
And it's sort of a love story, so it's good for Valentine's Day.
Well, it is definitely a story about family. And
more for family day on the Monday.
Yeah, there you go. I knew we'd find something.
Well done.
Always thinking.
There's a stat for you. We could release it on.
But I think they were just great. And then Anita Adams from the first weekend was club was really great. They gave the film out to their membership for the holidays. They like to highlight a film, and that ours was the one that they selected. So that was great, just to try and help build the audience, because it's not easy. Everybody is so busy these days, and we're inundated with content on our cell phones.
Everyone wants your attention.
I mean, even when I did my first digital series, it was like, oh, geez, like I'm competing with people's, like their updates on Tinder or like their likes here or there. Like there's always something to distract watching a piece of content, right? So.
Yeah, Parked was an amazing series, and we need to do Parked Part 2, I think. I was just going to say that to you now, Siobhan.
Okay. No, it's official. It's on the record. So anyone who wants to see Red Eye can go to nsi-canada.ca and look up Red Eye and check it out until the 28th of February. No, the 28th.
Yeah.
All right.
Wonderful.
Well, great. Siobhan and Lori, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Well, congratulations on the Leo Awards.
Two nominations.
Yeah, for the film,
Yeah.
It was really great to see Christine being acknowledged for her work, because I don't think most people realize she was driving the car. Like, she wasn't on a trailer.
This was not carpool karaoke.
No.
This
was. No, she was driving the car. And, like,
was,
not
yeah.
in her hometown. She's a Squamish-based person.
Oh,
so,
really?
You know.
Oh, my gosh.
At one time, we were in the car, and it was like everybody was from out of town. Like, they were like, where are we going? It was like, my DOP was Toronto-based.
Yeah. Just go straight.
So.
There was an interesting thing the first night after we were done filming. Christine thought she would drive home to Squamish.
Oh, yeah.
And after driving all night, I'm like, I don't think that's a really good idea. Please stay.
Lori kept calling me. She wants to leave.
She wants to leave.
I'm like, lock the door.
Let her leave. She's like, don't let her leave. And then
use your handcuffs.
And it's good. It ended up there was an accident on the highway, and they had shut down the highway in the morning.
Oh, wow.
So if she had gone.
Yeah.
We would have been hooped. We would have been making a whole other movie. Incomplete.
Thank you so much for having us, Dave.
Well, thanks so much for coming in. And stay in touch and let us know what's next.
Oh, we have all those things. We will.
Yeah. All right.
Absolutely. Okay. Thank you.
Care.
Bye.
Ta-ta.
Now the patriarchy is dead, and we killed it. If you identify as a woman, femme, trans, or non-binary, CITR wants you on the air. You can talk about literally whatever you want as long as you care about it. No worries if you have no experience, we'll train you in everything you need to know. Come by CITR and say hi.
Hey.
Hi.
Hello.
From 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday to Friday to help us never play Led Zeppelin on CITR 101.9 FM ever again. I could be you.
FunDrive 2020, CITR's annual fundraiser extravaganza, is almost upon us. This year's theme is Crush on CITR. And since we deal primarily in sound around here, we started wondering, what does a crush sound like?
Okay, I think. Oh my god. Is that? Yeah.
Ding.
Hey, do you want to make out? It's like that filter on Instagram. It's like. Da-da-da.
Well, as great as those answers were, we're kind of hoping this year a crush sounds a bit more like... Because your donations are what allow us to do, well, almost everything. Hosting free radio and podcast trainings, publishing the amazing Discorder magazine, producing local independent news, promoting and playing local music, and so much more. Our fund drive goal is to reach $30,000 by February 14th. You can show your crush on CITR right now by visiting citr.ca/donate.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. That's so nice. All right. Wow. That was exciting. That was great having those two in here. Okay. Just want a quick, we got just time for some, a couple of quick announcements here. Thursday night, next Thursday, the 6th of February, there's a special benefit going on to help raise money to help clean up the bushfires in Australia. The organization is called WIRES and the Australian Red Cross, and it's called Blues for Bushfires. It's happening at the Anza Club. I was going to play some music, but we ran out of time. Rowan Porter, Sandy Bone, Joni Miller, and the usual suspects, Alvaro Rojas, Bradley Barkman, Bryce Reed, Lisa Ray Simons, and many, many more. All proceeds going to WIRES and the Australian Red Cross. It's happening at the Anza Club, which is at 8th in Ontario, and it's happening on Thursday night, February 6th. Donations for entry at the door. Doors open at 7. Music starts at 8. Going to be a lot of fun. Don't want to miss it. And now let's go right on to the call board. Time for the Dave Radio Call Board, our weekly look at auditions and calls for crews and musicians and other contributors for productions around Metro Vancouver. We believe here that auditions announced should be open to artists of all cultural, sexual, gender, ability, and other identities. In fact, we encourage everyone to read for everything. Theater Under the Gun is now accepting submissions. Theater Under the Gun is a deadline-driven, insomnia-fueled creation, and you can be one of the creators. On April 21st, the selected artists will be presenting the plays created in the 48 hours beforehand. So a bunch of artists get together. They have 48 hours to put together a play, and then you go in and watch what they've done. You got to be chosen to be a part of it. And if you're interested in putting a group together, you can go to theaterwire.com and go to the blog to find out all the details on applying for Theater Under the Gun. An application deadline is next Friday, February 7th. There's a stage presence workshop coming up in February. It's called Le Jeu en Complicité, Fundamentals by Chloe Payne. When did acting become work? Get out of your head and learn to play through Le Jeu. Le Jeu is the game that should exist between actors and the audience. Actors at play follow their instincts, ready to change at a moment's notice. In this workshop, inspired by French clown master Philippe Gollier, students will learn to play, develop complicity, gain sensitivity, and embark on taking risks. It's happening on February 21st. Deadline for registration is February 19th. Cost is $100. If you're an equity member, it's only $80. And you can find out more at ChloeAlicePayne.com or go to Brown Paper Tickets and look up Le Jeu, L-E-J-E-U. Our good friends at Leaping Thespians have an audition call out. They're doing a show called How the West Was Won by Karen White and Leah Burrows. It's going to be happening at the Havana in April. And the auditions, it says mid-January, so I'm not sure if it's still going on or not, but give them a look because they might still be looking. They're looking for a female actor, age 25 to 50, all nationalities welcome. The character is it's a multi-character role, in a lesbian Western comedy. They prefer someone who's got some singing and dancing skills and a good ability to play a spectrum of masculine to feminine characters. Send an email and a small blurb about yourself to info@leapingthespians.com. North Shore Light Opera is doing Gilbert and Sullivan's Patience, and that's going to be happening in May. The auditions are this weekend at North Lonsdale United Church. And if you want to find out more about that, you can go to NSLOS, North Shore Light Opera Society.com, and there's a sign-up sheet for auditions there. We've got Miscast, a Broadway cabaret. This is a show that's going to be happening in Coquitlam, produced by Moving Mirror Productions. They're looking for volunteers to donate of an evening of after-school programming. This year's theme, performers will be asked to prepare one or two selections of their own choice. And if you want to find out more about that, you can go to movingmirrorproductions@gmail.com. Rain City Theatre presents an intimate and immersive production of Cantor and Ebb's Cabaret with a cast that truly reflects the rich diversity found in our own city. Rain City Theatre remains intent on staying and casting body positive. They encourage submissions from artists with a broad range of backgrounds, including but not limited to race, ethnicity, gender, sexuality, and indigeneity. The auditions are happening the 2nd and the 10th February, and the submission deadline is today, info@raincitytheater.com. And we'll throw one more in because we're almost out of time. North Van Community Players are doing Irma Brombeck at Wits End, and they are looking to cast Irma, a housewife and syndicated columnist aged 40 to 60. If you're younger than that, don't mind being aged up a bit. That's fine, too. The auditions are happening on the 2nd and 3rd of February at Hendry Hall in North Van. And you can email Sarah Arnold at Sarah E. Arnold, S-A-R-A-H-E-A-R-N-O-L-D @gmail.com. I was going to play Russian Tim's version of Rasputin, but I ran out of time. So maybe next week. That's our show. So thanks for spending your lunch hour with us. Remember, if you have a song that needs airplay, a show that needs audience, an audition that needs actors, a class that needs students, or a film shoot that needs background, we're here for you. Send your details to DaveRadioPodcast@hotmail.com, and please like us on Facebook, on Twitter, and Instagram. We're at CITR Dave Radio. I also wasn't able to do a tribute to a very dear friend of ours, the great Ron Baldwin, who was a fixture at the Railway Club through the 80s and 90s. He was a regular at the Smiling Buddha before that. A real East Vancouver kind of guy. What you'd really call an all-around a guy who knew a lot about history and movies and music and just all kinds of cool stuff. Someone who was always, you'd always get an interesting conversation out of him. He passed away kind of unexpectedly a couple of weeks ago, and there's going to be a memorial for him at Glen Haven next weekend. You can find out details on Facebook. Lots of people have posted about him, and he was our friend, and we miss him deeply. So hats off to you, Ron, and I think that's about all I have to say. So next week, it's Fund Drive, CITR's annual fundraising effort. We'll be here to beg you for money, and don't stick around because Audrey is up next with Too Dreamy and Beppe Crispin at 2, and then Nardwar the Human Serviette at 3:30. And we will be back here next week. See you then. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
FunDrive 2020, CITR's annual fundraising week, is happening between February 5th and February 14th.
This is the 1 week of the year where we ask you to dig deep and give what you can to support local, independent, community radio. Our goal this year is to raise $30,000, which is a lot, but with your help, we can definitely get there. This year's Fun Drive theme is Crush on CITR, and we've got some amazing Crush-appropriate swag for you when you donate. We're talking about branded CITR and Discorder candy hearts, limited edition toques and mugs, and even on-air song dedications. That's right, donate the right amount and you can publicly express your crush on someone in maybe the most romantic way possible, by dedicating a song to them which will play on CITR on Valentine's Day. Fun Drive is happening February 5th to the 14th, but you can show your love for CITR right now by going to citr.ca/donate. And thank you.
That's why they call them crushes. 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 Crushes.
It's the Shindig 2020 Finals. CITR's 16-band Blood Sport Elimination Challenge is coming to a dramatic close on Friday, January 31st at Redgate Art Society. The four surviving bands are going head-to-head in one final night of a no-holds-barred musical knockout. Come down to Redgate this Friday to catch it all go down. Doors are at 8 p.m., $10 at the door, though no one will be turned away for lack of funds.